Welcome everyone to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's Monthly Leadership Forum. Today we're thrilled to have Bridget Schultz. Bridget is the director of the Better Life Lab and the Good Life Initiative at New America. She is a journalist and author who writes widely for publications like The Washington Post, Slate, Time.com, The Guardian, and others. She was a longtime staff writer for The Washington Post and Washington Post Magazine, where she won a number of reporting and writing awards and was part of the team that won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize. Her 2014 New York Times bestselling book, Overwhelmed, How to Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time, was named the Washington Post NPR Notable Nonfiction Book of the Year, which helped spark a national conversation about overwork, burnout, productivity, busyness, gender roles, and the toll that outdated policies and cultural attitudes have taken on modern lives. And how to move forward, which is really important. Bridget is a sought-out voice on work life, productivity, and gender issues. She has spoken at events around the globe and quoted as an expert and featured in numerous publications like Forbes, Fortune, The Atlantic, The Times of London, The Irish Times, The Financial Times, and Fast Company. She also has appeared on the Today Show, Good Morning America, The Katie Couric Show, MSNBC, CNN, wow, The Morning Show, BBC, the CBC, Morning Edition, and other television and radio programs. You can follow her on Twitter. She's at Bridget Schultz, and that's spelled B-R-I-G-I-D-S-C-H-U-L-T-E. So I'm most intrigued, Bridget. Thank you again for being with us today from Washington, D.C.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Sure. I'm most intrigued with your book, mostly because of how you got to it and how you decided to write it. Because you're having your own issues, as we all do as moms. You're having your own issues, and you decided to go and research it and then write this book. So tell us a little about that journey and how you came to write it.
Yeah, I often call this an accidental book, but I often think of it as almost a gift, because I hadn't even started writing it yet, but, when I was in this situation, I just was really, overwhelmed doesn't even describe it. You know, I was trying to, you're just trying to do your best at work, and, you know, you want to do more than survive, right? You want to thrive. You want to, find meaning, and you want to, make a difference. And I was just feeling completely overwhelmed and inadequate at work, and just always, scattered. And then,
how old were your kids at that time?
So, the kids were pretty little. I can't even remember. They were, still in single digits, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And, and I just felt like I didn't have the kind of time that I wanted or the attention or the energy to devote to being kind of the mother that I thought I should be. And, when I compared myself to, my mom or stay-at-home moms, I felt like I was always coming up short. My house was always a mess. My laundry was never folded. I didn't ever work out. I was overweight. I had stress eczema. I just felt like I was a mess. And so in the middle of all of this, I got put on this committee at the Washington Post where I was working full-time as a reporter, and we were looking at readership numbers and seeing a big drop-off in women readers, this big gap between male and female readers. And so the powers that be wanted to try to figure out why. Well, why were women not reading the newspaper? And so they put together this women readers group, and I got put on it, and mainly because when they were making the announcement, I went up to one of the editors afterwards. He said, maybe we just need to hire women babysitters, and sort of made a big joke out of it. And it sort of irritated me, and I went up to him afterwards, and I said, listen, can I just tell you how many of my friends come up to me and say, Bridget, I'm really sorry, but I just canceled my subscription because every day the newspaper comes, every day it piles up in the corner, every day I don't read it, and it's one more thing to feel bad about. And I just I totally got that,
I felt that way about The Economist, I was stacking, Economists were stacking up. I'm like, I can't even read these anymore. Yeah.
Right? It's like, one more thing to just feel like you're failing at.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was put on this Women Readers Committee, and it was wild because the first thing we did is we sat around, and it became almost like this, encounter group or something, because we found that we had a hard time reading the newspaper in the morning, and we worked for the newspaper. And if we were having trouble, no wonder other people were, because we were doing all of the kid stuff, or, people had other kind of caregiving responsibilities. It's like we were all trying to cram two really full lives into 24 hours. And so we figured, well, women are just really busy. They're just too busy to read the newspaper. And being journalists, we wanted the data. And so I said, well, I don't know. I'll see what's out there. People were like, yeah, Nielsen. Don't they figure out how much, how much TV we watch? And so somebody's got to figure out how we spend our time. So not really knowing anything, I kind of just Googled, like, women, busy, mother, time. And I said, I had nothing more, inspired than that. And and what was wild is that what popped up were all of these time use researchers. There's basically an academic field where people, they tend to be sociologists or economists or psychologists, and they study how we use our time. And they use something that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, they call it the American Time Use Diary, time use study. And other countries have similar, like European time studies. And so I had no idea.
Time use.
What's that? Yeah, so I had no idea this even existed, so I called this one guy, and I just said, what does your time diary stuff say? We're figuring women aren't reading the newspaper because they're too busy. And he said, you're wrong. Women aren't busy. Women have 30 hours of leisure a week. And I about fell off my chair. And he said, yeah, women have more leisure time now than they did in the 1960s, even though more of them are working outside the home in the marketplace. And I was sort of speechless, like, are you effing kidding me, And I just said, well, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have any leisure time,
Like, who is doing this?
It's like, I don't even sleep enough at night, I'm lucky if I get my hair blow dried, And I just said, I don't have 30 hours of leisure. And he said, yes, you do. Come and do a time study, and I'll show you where your leisure is. And so this whole exploration of how we're feeling overwhelmed and how we combine work and life, definitely started from my own experience as a working mother, but it really expanded to be kind of everybody, women and men, and whether you have kids and you don't, or whatever your age is. Mm-hmm. What shocked me is how many people are really struggling with this. We all are struggling with, what to do and how to spend our time in the way that that we feel like we're having meaningful and full lives, and most of us are feeling completely overloaded and overwhelmed. So I did this time study, and he found 27 hours of what he called leisure, and I, looked at it, and it was, little bits and scraps of garbage time. I'm like, this is awful. This is the best you got for me? 5 minutes here and 10 minutes there, and so I wrote a magazine story in the Washington Post magazine, and I did. I thought that would be the end of it. And instead, it really opened up a whole new life, if you will, because all of those people responded and just said, you wrote about my life and you climbed into my head, and how did you do that? And at that point, I just thought, wow, this can't be an epidemic of personal failure. There's got to be something more going on, and I want to try to understand what that is. So I had a real gift that I had a wonderful agent and a wonderful publisher who really got that what I was trying to do was sort of like the next phase of, the second shift, what the great book that Arlie Hochschild did, and, the next phase of the overworked American. It's like, what's going on? And more, is there anything we can do about it? Like, I really wanted to know, why are things the way they are, and how can they be better? And what use my skills as a journalist to really look and tell those stories.
So what was the main finding in terms of why it's so difficult for us to find leisure time?
Well, there are a couple reasons. And, probably the most, the biggest one is also the most obvious one, and that is life has really changed for most people in the last couple decades. We have a majority of mothers who work. Family life is really different. How we form families is really different. We have a majority of kids who are being raised in families where all parents are working, whether it's single parent or dual parents. And yet we still have these really outdated cultural notions about who should be the caretaker, and we still think that women should be. And so we expect women to still do all the stuff that they did when they didn't have work outside the home. So that kind of, again, you kind of cram two lives into one. But then on top of that, the standards for what we expect mothers to do, and also women, who we expect women to be, there's good research that shows we've never had higher expectations of women, which is insane. So just as our life becomes more complicated, we now have ratcheted up the standards for what we need to be and do to kind of meet this ideal. And on the other hand, when we look at what's happened at work, you know, when I would report and I'd talk to people, they'd be like, you know, my dad was an engineer, my dad was a doctor. And then in the 1950s and 60s, he was home by 5 every night for dinner, you know, and I'm an engineer and I can't get out of work, at, you know, till 11 o'clock at night. What's happened?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
at the same time that we have this ratcheting up in the personal sphere, particularly for women, we also have this ratcheting up at work where, really since the 1980s, the research shows that for knowledge workers, the expectation for additional hours and overwork has really gone off the charts, that that's what we expect, that's what we reward, that's what we think produces the best work. And so you kind of have this ever-escalating increase of what you're supposed to do at work. You have this ever-escalating increase of, like, who you're supposed to be at home. And then the third thing that's really happening is, like a century ago, you showed the way your status, or we really valued leisure time. You know, one of the early strikes, you know, women textile workers, it was the bread and roses strike, and they said, we strike for bread, we want fair pay, and we want, you know, safe working environment, but we also want roses. We want the time to enjoy the fruits of our labor. So early on, there was a real understanding that it wasn't just the idle rich that needed leisure time, but everybody needed time off and a way to have time to reflect for yourself or connect with your family or enjoy your life, you know, to have a hobby. Who has hobbies anymore, right? Or I guess if you do, you monetize them and then you sell stuff on Etsy, I guess, you know. But just to do things for the joy of it. You know, I was just going to, the final point is that we've really lost that. And what's really happened, again, you know, something happened in the 1980s that was a real turning point. We started to see that busyness was how we began to show our status. And just even to think about how you talk to each other, you know, how are you doing? Oh, man, we're fried. You know, you never have time to, like, to meet with somebody. Or if you say you didn't do anything over the weekend, you sound like you're a loser, you know. And so you have this ratcheting up at work, ratcheting up at home, and this ratcheting up of like how you should spend your time, and that the crazier you are, the kind of quote-unquote better and more important you are. So that's a lot of kind of the stew that we're swimming in that we kind of can't see. And that would be the first thing that I argue for in the book is we have to start seeing this water, and then we can choose whether we want to stay in it or begin to make better choices.
Well, and I'm also wondering, too, that this might not have come up in your time you study, because it might have been, what, in 2012 or before you wrote the book, so I don't know. But doesn't social media play into this? I mean, I can't believe how much people spend on Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and Instagram and Snapchat. And I'm just shocked about how much time people have for that.
You know, it's a
time.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. And before social media, it was TV. You know, you do see these kind of crazy statistics about how much we work, but then you see these other crazy statistics about how much time we spend on screens, or before that, how many hours we spent watching TV. The difference is with TV, we often would keep it on. It was almost like wallpaper. It was always on, but in the background. But with social media, it's very demanding. It's very engaging. And, you see people walking into walls, you know, walking down the street because they're so focused on what's on their phone. So I think
it's
that is a
real thing. It's individual, too. It's not like, you know, with TV, at least you can watch it with somebody.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Although you could argue that there is sort of, you know, connection, like with Snapchat and texting, that there is some element of communication with digital stuff. But you're right, that actually takes a lot of our time. You know, email is insane. There is one study that found that just between dealing with email and, you know, meetings and other kind of like getting ready for meetings, but primarily email, the average knowledge worker spends only 6 hours a week doing concentrated work, that we are just drowning in all of this kind of digital and very addictive kind of media.
So you talked a little bit about supermoms. Let's focus on that for a second, because And you just mentioned, the question I have is how does this pressure for women to be super moms come from? But I think that you could have answered that in terms of there's an expectation that even though they're working, they still are the ones that, there's an expectation, a societal expectation that they're still the ones that take kids to school, deal with all the stuff at school. If the kid, the thing that I think is the best way to describe it is if the kid is sick, who stays home from school, from work?
Right, right. And is it even a conversation? Right, and is it even a conversation? And I think what you find is that a lot of couples, and my husband and I fell into this, and I write about it in the book, we didn't even have the conversation. There was just this expectation that it should be me. And some of that is, when you think about it, our policy and our corporate or cultural practice, that kind of like it reinforces that, because, you know, we're the only advanced economy that doesn't have any kind of paid family or parental leave. But what we do have, more or less, is, well, you know, some companies will have maternity leave or more of a history of maternity leave. And so then we create this notion that, like, well, women should have time off because they've given birth or they've adopted a child or fostered a child. Men don't need that. And so then very early on, when you're forming those family dynamics, you create the expectation that it should be the woman who is the default parent. The woman is, like you say, if it's a sick day, you're on. If it's a snow day, you're on. If, you know, school left out early, you're on.
Yeah.
And what I'm arguing is we need to really reexamine that. The world has changed. It's time for those expectations to change too. So couples really need to have that conversation early on, or like my husband and I, we had it in 20 years in and began to make some changes. I am not biologically wired to make all the summer camp plans. You know, there's no reason. You know, it's like I do not have some special gene that makes me the one to, make all the doctor appointments. You know, I think we also need to move away from the idea that, you know, you hear couples, and I really try to counsel people to listen to their language when they'll say, oh, my husband is so great, he really helps out, or my partner, you know, is so great because when I need help, you know, he really is willing to pitch in. It's like, uh-uh. It needs to be right from the start. You are partners. You know, you both created this being. You both need to be responsible for this being. You know, and that means the physical work. That also means the planning and logistics work, because that's mental labor. And I think we don't realize that's invisible, but it takes up a lot of brain power, you know, just trying to remember all that stuff. And you really do need to share it. The best advice that I got from somebody when she was trying to explain mental labor, when I was still kind of doing everything, and I didn't think it could change. It was like, what are you talking about? And she said that she and her husband decided to change off days they would be responsible for making dinner. And she was really busy, and she was really involved in what she was doing at work, and her husband called and said, what do you want for dinner? And she paused, and she said, to not have to think about it. And I thought that was brilliant, because that's really what you're doing. When you're truly sharing, you're not only sharing the physical labor, you get some of your mental space back. And when my husband and I, you know, I write about that in the book, we really, we went from a really bad place where I nearly was dividing the furniture up in my head and ready to divorce him to a much better place of sharing. And the first thing that I noticed is just how much more space I had to think about other things.
Well, and you can draw from your own experience, of course, and I'm sure you've, and when you're consulting and talking to other people, I'm sure you could draw from that as well. But, I mean, what, in that moment where, when the kid was sick and you, there was an expectation that you would have to stay home, and you did that time, but then how did then you bring the conversation and decide to have the sort of the bigger conversation? How did you do that?
Yeah. How did
How should one do that, I should say? If you didn't think that the way you did it was great, then how should one do that?
Yeah. I don't think that the way I did it was great. It was definitely not great. Well, you know, and through the years, I would try, and what I would do, like, I would write down all the stuff that needed to get done, and, like, who does doctor, me, dentist, me, grocery shopping, me, bill paying, me, taxes, me, and then I would show it to him, and I'd be so angry, and then he would be like, well, I do this and this and this, and it became this, like, weird standoff, and we never got past that, of like, well, you don't appreciate me, well, F you, love you, ugh. And it was just, we'd never get anywhere, and that was really, really unproductive. And it really did, the crazy thing is what really helped us was getting to a crisis point where it got so crazy, it was so unfair. And I write about it in the book, it was this crazy Thanksgiving that just went awry. And if you could imagine how crazy Thanksgiving usually is, and I was doing all of that and more. And I was really angry, but then I got really sad too. It's just like when we first decided to get married, and we didn't get married till later. I really wanted to have a partner. I didn't want to have kind of the traditional marriage that I saw my parents have. And then I found myself, wow, I'm right here, and on top of that, I've got this really demanding full-time job. This really sucks. This is awful. And so what I did is, and this is what worked for me, and, you know, other people will find different things that work for them, but, you know, I'm a reporter, and so I took a notebook, and I just said, let's go for a walk, so that one of us couldn't stomp off, and it was sort of like we'd get out of our house where we kind of like everything is familiar. And also we didn't, this is really important sometimes for some guys, particularly, you know, my husband's kind of probably an older generation, to not have eye contact. You know, so you're walking and you're looking out.
We do it too, yeah.
Yeah, and or driving, being in a car, this can also be helpful.
That's
and
right.
I took out this notebook and I basically started interviewing him, but mm-hmm. from an idea that I really wanted to understand. I just mm-hmm. like, you know, this, you know, and I tried to explain sort of from my perspective, this is what I see, and this is what's really painful, and this is where we started, and how did we get here? And we just started taking long walks, and I think because I wasn't accusing, and it wasn't sort of that, like, amped up, tense atmosphere when it usually is, when we're kind of arguing about chores, it just became, it took a lot of that kind of emotional energy out of it. And we were kind of able to see it a little bit more clearly. And he could see, it's like, wow, yeah, I guess I figured since you breastfeed, you just, you know, you breastfed the kids, you just had this like magical maternal instinct. And I thought that too. And it really took reporting in the book to find out that that really isn't true, that there is no such thing as a maternal instinct. You have slightly, you know, the research shows that, you know, like maybe a half a second more of a response to a crying child. But that mm-hmm. men are also physiologically and biologically wired for nurture. I mean, when you think about it, we are the same species. It's not that surprising. You know, so it shouldn't be this divided.
It's not that much
divided.
Difference, right.
Not that much difference. And so that's the thing. It's like I would just really encourage people to, you know, try to take the accusation and the anger. Because I did. I felt like I had this, like, I call it like this low-level radioactive waste of resentment for years. I was so angry all the time.
Mm-hmm,
and then that doesn't lend itself to having a good conversation. But the second thing that I'll say is I had to see what I was doing to perpetuate it as well. I had to see that it wasn't just his fault, and it's not that he was the bad guy or he was like a jerk, but that I was acting in that way because of how I was reacting kind of to our cultural icons and trying to be the ideal mother and what I thought I should be. And so I was playing, I was playing into it just as much as he was. And mm-hmm. I learned this other term that I didn't realize, but I totally was guilty of. They call it maternal gatekeeping. You know, like mm-hmm. When I would be on maternity leave, you know, and you're exhausted and you spend the whole day, and honest to God, you might have clipped the baby's fingernails. I don't know what else you did, but it was felt really busy. And then, you know, he would come home at the end of the day. I still wouldn't have had a shower. And he would be like, you know, what did you do all day? I know you want to punch him, right? Because it's like, what do you mean, what did you do all day? And then you just wanted some time, so I would hand him the baby. And he's like, oh, I just need some time. And then the baby would be, unfamiliar with him. He wouldn't know what to do. You know, they didn't have time together, and so then the baby would fuss, and then I'd come back and swoop and take the baby and cry. It's like, you're an idiot. You don't know what you're doing, and I'm so tired. And what I didn't realize is that what he really did need was what I had, which was time. And I needed to physically remove myself, and he needed to figure out, okay, when the baby cries, what does the baby need? And so by me swooping in, I not only kind of continued that resentment that I had toward him, but I kept him from developing that confidence, that competence, and that skill. So I guess that would be the other thing that I would really encourage people is that if your partner cannot or does not or is too afraid to take a kind of a leave when their baby's just born or just adopted, create a space. Like every Saturday morning is like, you know, daddy and me time, or Sunday afternoon, or whatever it is, and then you physically remove yourself, and you do not answer the phone. It's like if he freaks out because the baby doesn't know how to take a bottle, he needs to figure that out, and then that's, you know, create that space in your own life, however you need to do that, to, you know, to create the dynamic that you both are caregivers, and you both are good at it. You're going to do it differently, and that's okay. And it's actually going to be better for your kid and better for yourselves, for your relationship.
Mm-hmm. I want to get into some of the tips you have for future generations, well, current and future generations. But before we do that, let's put everybody on, unmute everybody and see if they have any questions or comments. So far, you've been describing for us your personal story and also some good tips in terms of how to deal with a spouse, partner around. I love that maternal gatekeeping. I'm definitely guilty of that, for sure. So I that's a good one. That's a good term. So anyone have any questions or comments? And please say who you are first.
Yeah, this is Jim. I'll jump in and ask a question. That's okay.
Hi. Hey, Jim.
It's kind of funny. I try to take some of the pressure off of my wife, but when I do, she sees it as a more of the, like, I'm not doing it right, or, you know, I'm not doing it good enough for you kind of thing. How
right.
do you overcome that?
Yeah, no, that is, and, man, that is a really important thing. It's like women need to own that they are part of the problem and part of the solution, and that is really part of the problem. And I was totally guilty of that. You know, I think that the way you deal with that is having that conversation that, you know, you are partners. You both are parents. You're different people. You do different things, you know, things in different ways. And you're going to parent in different ways. And your child is going to benefit because of that. And that she needs to back off the judgment. She needs to back off kind of, nipping at your heels to do it her way. She needs to give you space and accept that. And, you know, go take a yoga class. Go for a walk. Go meet a friend for coffee and just say, God bless you, you know, because that's, ultimately going to make your family life better and your relationship better.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim.
You know, one thing I did, if I could just add something really quickly,
sure.
I think
sure.
another thing that really helped me, because when I was reporting on the book, I was learning about all of this, and I was sort of like getting woke, if you will, and my husband really wasn't. He was doing his job, you know, he wasn't thinking about gender roles and norms and history and cultural expectations all day like I was. Catherine Berndorf is a psychologist in New York, and I was interviewing her for the book, and she gave me she calls it the relationship equation, that really helped me a lot, because you tend to think, oh, you know, I really want my partner to change, I really want things to change, and she said, if you think of a relationship as like A plus B equals C, and you want the relationship to change, well, if you change, say A becomes A prime, you know, then C becomes C prime. You know, the relationship does change. And you don't control B. That is the other person. But you can change. And then that will change the relationship. And then ultimately, in my case, it did change my husband. Our relationship, the way we divide labor, is so much different than it was before. And it's made things so much better.
This is really good stuff. I know we're really spending a lot of time on relationship stuff, and I know there's some of the things in the book as well, but this is really important, and this is why people separate, so because they can't figure this out. So this is great stuff. Anyone have a question or a comment? Anyone else? Okay, no problem. So I want to shift a little bit to what does this mean for future generations. I want to, and there's other things in your book I'd like to get to. So there's certainly the gender roles as one issue. What are some other issues in the book that future generations should pay attention to?
You know, it's one of the things that I think a lot about. I look a lot at our work and work culture because I think a lot of the overwhelm kind of starts and is centered there. And we talk a lot these days about future of work and what's coming and, you know, automation and AI and, you know what future generations are going to deal with. And there's no question that the nature of work is changing, how we work is changing. But I think that before we can really address some of those challenges, we really have to look at what I call the now of work. You know, if, you know, for knowledge workers, if we're moving into more kind of independent work or independent contracting or gig work, or, you know, kind of like we're all going to become a nation of freelancers, I think what's really important is to understand that right now, with these kind of cultural expectations of always on work, we could very easily carry that into future of work. And that's, you know, we talk about, oh, well, it's going to be great. You can have flexibility, and you'll be able to combine your caregiving or your life responsibilities. It'll open up possibilities. You don't have to be wedded to a place or a 9-to-5 or a job or commute. And that's all true. There's all sorts of upsides to that. But I think we also need to be thinking about the downsides to that, that it actually is a skill to learn how to work flexibly and to create boundaries so that you're not kind of constantly always working. Because what happens when you're always working and kind of always checking emails, it's literally your brain stays in what they call a vigilant state, where you're kind of vigilant and working. And if you really want, you can argue this for sort of like quality of life or soul refreshing leisure, or you could actually argue this in terms of business and innovation and making your own skills better. But, you know, in a knowledge economy, if you're really thinking about what's the next big idea, what's the next great solution or innovation, you're really only going to get those ideas, that insight. Neuroscience has actually found that they come in moments where we're kind of off task, where we're not in that vigilant brain mode. Our brain works in two patterns. One is concentrated on task, and the other is this kind of more dreamy, off-task kind of daydreaming kind of mode, if you will. And you really need both of those modes to do your best work, to kind of have that, you know, to feel like fully alive and meaningful. And so if we're constantly in that always on, always checking, always vigilant mode, you're actually robbing yourself not only of the ability to daydream and have that sort of joyful human experience, but potentially of having the next big idea that would actually help you at your job, at your work. So I think that that's one of the things we really need to be, you know, when you talk about future generations, we really need to be very mindful and not jump into the future of work and really be thinking about what are the skills I need right now that can be translatable for future of work, but are actually going to make work better right now.
Well, I'm totally with you on that. I think one of the things that we try to do is that we use words that are similar, it's not exactly the same, but similar in terms of, like, you need to have divergent thinking and you need to have convergent thinking. So it kind of marries to what you're saying around, you know, your divergent thinking is thinking about, you know, the off-path, daydreaming, brainstorming, wild ideas, whereas a convergence is taking those ideas and, you know, distilling them and being more on task and concentrated. So it kind of, it's somewhat analogous to what you're talking about. We can't be doing focused work all the time.
Right. Right, exactly. And yet so many of us are. Like, if you're constantly checking your email all the time, which so many people do, you're never allowing your brain to get into that state that would create that, create the ability for you to have insight.
And, again, I don't know if you know the stats on this, but I'm wondering how much people really are checking email versus checking Facebook. I wasn't on Facebook for so long because I didn't want to get sucked into it, right? And I just said, all right, I'm just doing Twitter. And so I check Twitter like 10 times a day. So I think that's a lot. And I don't do it when I'm very good about boundaries around dinner and around kids and things like that. But I still check it a lot. And I imagine, and then I just got on Facebook a couple of weeks ago, like really looked at it, and I was shocked how many people are looking at it all the time. They have to be because they're answering my stuff like right away. So they're looking at it like constantly.
Yeah.
And so that's going. I mean, I don't know how you. We must have stats on that.
Well, there is that sense. Yeah, email, you know, it's the same, you know, Twitter, Facebook, all of that kind of like
all,
that kind of,
all that, together.
All that, yeah, right. You put it all together, it all just sucks you into that kind of like vigilant mode. And, you know, I think that's, again, we're learning more about it. I think it's still so new, this technology. We haven't figured out how to use it effectively, and I think we're kind of like getting lost in it. It's you know, the research shows that you know, kind of you get that same dopamine rush when you get like a somebody likes your post, you know, or like retweets you, you get that dopamine rush the same way that you do, like you know, it's like the pleasure center. It's like it works in the same kind of addiction basal ganglia in your brain. So I think that we need to understand that it's seductive, that it's addictive. You know, I don't think that we need to be Luddites, because there's a lot that's really great about it. But that's another skill, to learn how to create boundaries around it so that you use it in a way that kind of fuels whatever your priorities are, and that you don't kind of get lost or sucked in. And one of the strategies that I use is I set a timer, you know, because that is actually, it's kind of a fun thing to go down the rabbit hole. It's like, oh, I didn't know about this. Oh, look at this. It's so interesting.
Yep,
and that
yep.
is kind of fun, but then you don't want to lose your entire day to it. So put on a timer and let yourself do it for 10, 15 minutes, and then, you know, do it at discrete times, kind of put boundaries around it, and then come back. I think that to back that up, what I really, you know, and I'm sure you talk about this a lot, you know, when I talk about this, I talk about time a lot, and people are always wanting to know, it's almost like, how can I get more done? How can I cram more stuff in? How can I be
right.
more productive? And I think that's really the wrong question. Some of the best advice I got is that you can't manage time, but you can manage your priorities and your expectations for what you do in time. And I think that gets to that whole, like, can I have it all kind of question. Well, what does all mean, and what is most important to you? And make time for what's most important. And that would be at work and at home, like with your love, and then also at play. You know, you do need all three of those great arenas of life to, you know, feel like you're living this full life. But I think the other thing to think about is you don't need to have it all today. And you don't need to have, like, make sure that you have all three things and perfectly balanced on Tuesday. You know, kind of take a wider lens. And, you know, I imagine, in a month you can make time for that. Or people are like, oh, I never have time to play. You know what, in 1 month you could find 30 minutes to do something just for fun. You know, and schedule it in there and plan it. And then the more you do it, the better you're going to get at it. And it'll be a skill that you develop.
So let's talk about, real quick, the kid situation with this. Because I have an 11-year-old, and he's completely addicted to iPad, all that. And so I have to put very stringent limits, because otherwise he would, you know, sleep with the thing. So he doesn't at my house. So, which is good. But I think that, you know, I was at dinner yesterday, and there was a baby watching something on an iPad, and I mean, this is like a one-year-old. So all the parents are having dinner, and I totally understand that, so they can have a dinner and not have a crying child. But where do we draw the line here, and how do we manage this, and what are some tips you have for that?
Yeah, no, those are really good questions. And believe me, I've got a 16-year-old and a nearly 19-year-old. And, you know, sometimes I just I want to take all the chargers away, you know, and I've lost it. My, you know, said to them, it's like, come, put your phone down, live your real life, not your virtual life.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a challenge, and it's a real frustration. And you know, it's something that I struggle with as well, and I can certainly share the research, but, you know, as a parent, it's something I'm struggling with. And I think part of it is, especially when they're young, creating contracts, like family contracts with expectations, just like you're saying. And everybody, so it's not a constant fight, because that's really wearing. And if it's a constant fight, you're eventually going to give in, because you just don't have the energy. And kids are smart, and, you know, if there's that addictive draw, they're going to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. So come up with a family contract, get their buy-in, have them sign it, and then post it. And then, you know, there are some really good strategies. Sometimes parents put a basket out, so before dinner time, all the phones and devices go in that basket, so that dinner time is a device-free zone. And we've tried that, and my son will do it, I'll do it. My husband sometimes, well, I need this for work. And he's almost as bad as the kids sometimes, you know. But you have to make it a priority that having unconnected time so you can really connect to each other is really critical. So that's important. You know, some people do kind of Sabbath, you know, Sabbath oases and say Sunday is just a time to go look at the clouds and, you know, not go on Candy Crush or whatever. So there are different strategies you can take, but I think, you know, doing that as a family and talking about why it's important and kind of what you're gonna gain, what the benefits are, rather than thinking about it as a punishment, because then you could have a kid who's just watching the clock, waiting to get it back, you know. So you want to create that pull factor, like what's cool about not always being on the phone, like maybe go for a hike or, you know, find something that you guys really enjoy doing together.
Yeah, this is reminding me of the book Alone Together by Jerry Durkle.
Yeah,
if y'all haven't read that book, it's actually probably 6 or 7 years old now, at least. But it really made a difference to me. And tons of research around this very notion around families and the idea of you're together, but you're really alone because you're not with the people and connecting. And just having those contracts. I mean, I think dinner, trying to have a contract around that is, you know, not that necessarily is enough, but it's certainly the start.
Well, you know, this is what's important. There's really good research that shows, you know, it's crazy that parents today, particularly mothers, are spending more time with their kids than ever before, you know, because there's all this kind of, again, ratcheting up of standards. And so there was some interesting research that was done to try to see, does that time really matter? What really matters for kids? And, you know, it's not the quantity of time that really matters. I mean, certainly presence does matter. That gives certain kids a sense of security. But what really mattered was quality of time. And also what really mattered was stress level. So if your time together and connection is like running around to different lessons and making sure they have cello and karate and all that stuff, you know, and you're stressed, that stress works like a contagion. And that's not good time. The kids are going to pick that up. You know, but quality time where you just sink into the moment, whatever that moment is, and it doesn't have to be extraordinary. It's like, you know, make doing the dishes kind of a cool way of connecting. And I think why that's really important is that, you know, when they've done longevity studies and they've looked at people and who lives longest and who feels most fulfilled or, you know, I think happy is sort of maybe too lie the word, but like who feels that their lives have had the most meaning. Over and over again, there's a study out of Harvard. It's the people who've had the strongest connections with others, with family and friends, who have the most sense of fulfillment in life. So that connection with others really is critical. It's the source of what makes humans happy, and so that life is worth living.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, my son the other day asked me, why are we here? Like, yeah, okay, we know the big day, we're doing that. Why are we here?
Well, it's gonna be a philosophy.
Yeah, I think we're here to connect. That's why we're here. That's it.
Yeah.
It's not that hard. Well, we're winding down time here, but I wanted to ask a few more questions. There was something in your book around a story about a researcher that collected Christmas letters. Analyze how busyness has evolved. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so that was interesting because it was one of the questions that I had, like, you know, where did this sense of busyness being the status symbol, where did that come from and how did that start? And so I found this researcher, and that's she studies language and communication and sort of the, you know, messages we send each other by the language we use. And she'd been collecting Christmas letters since the 1960s. So I went out to visit her, and it was, wow, she's in Fargo, North Dakota, you know, Fargo State University. And, you know, and I just was like, really? I thought that people in Fargo would have been, you know, I thought maybe people felt overwhelmed in, like, big cities or, you know, the coastal areas. And that was one of the things that was really revelatory is most of these letters were from Midwestern states, you know, North and South Dakota, and starting in this, you know, you could read the letters from the 60s. We spent an afternoon reading through, she's got them organized by year, and you'd read in the 60s, they were lovely, sort of, you know, greetings of the season, and, you know, that sense of connection, like you were talking about, really, she had little letters on the top, and she would have an A, and I'm like, well, what does that mean? Like, it's a good letter. And she's like, A for authentic. You know, it's an authentic sense of themselves, authentic connection. And then you get up kind of to the letters where they are now. There are very few letters that had A's on them. They were not authentic. They were all sort of posturing. And they were exhausting to read. They were like, oh, you know, that's like, they were like single-spaced, and they went on for pages, and they were just like, almost brag sheets of like, oh, I drive so much. I drive 100 miles a day to all these different carpools, and our kids are doing this and this and this. And, you know, and we all laugh about it. People kind of know, you know, they know they're going to get the letter. I mean, everybody seems to get it. And we're better than you, and we're doing more stuff than you. And so she would circle all this language that really kind of showed how people were, again, trying to posture and this show how important they were. And so I thought that was really fascinating that those letters kind of mirror what's happened in society, that, you know, not only to show status, but to show that you fit in, that you're a member of the club, that you're not only important but worthy. You know, you have to, or we feel like we have to kind of project this crazy busyness, whether it's really real or not. And it's interesting, this researcher, her name is Anne Burnett, she calls it the non-choice choice. You know, you feel like you don't have any other choice but to be busy if you want to feel like you fit in. And so that's what I'm really interested in, is how do you disrupt that feeling of non-choice choice? Because busyness really is a choice. And how do you help people regain that sense of choice without feeling guilty or bad or unworthy, that, you know, you don't have to live fast and furious and kind of your life screaming by?
Is this a middle class or upper middle class problem? And this is one of Anne-Marie Schaffler's issues. You know, she's been dealing with. It's like, you know, she gets kind of, I love her, but she gets kind of criticized sometimes because she's talking about, you know, upper middle class women. And
yeah,
the way you just described that, most of what we've been talking about, you know, about knowledge workers, about, you know, I would put that in that upper middle class. So how does this research, what does the research look like in terms of lower middle class? I know that there's busyness, but it's more maybe survival busyness.
Mm-hmm.
And so this maybe doesn't, not necessarily the same, or what does the research say about that?
Yeah, no, this is a really important point. I write about it a little bit in the book as well, and I spent a lot of time writing it, working on that, you know, at the Better Life Lab, because we want everybody to have a better life, not just, you know, people with means and education. And I think what's important, a couple of things to remember, is when you talk about culture, it is the middle and upper middle class that set the culture. And so then it does end up affecting everybody. So right now we have made busyness this sort of badge of honor. Now, how that translates for, you know, low-wage workers and hourly workers, their lives are crazy. You know, because if where overwhelm and stress come from, it's feeling a lack of control and an inability to predict. So, you know, that's pretty much their life right there. You know, if you're a retail worker and you're on an on-demand schedule, you find your babysitter, you take several buses, you get in, and, oh, by the way, we don't need you anymore. So now you're out all of that bus fare, and you're out of childcare, and you've got to go home, you've got nothing, and now you're in the hole. So their lives are much more chaotic, much more complicated, and overwhelming in a different way. And where the busyness comes in is that their lives really are busy in that sense of it just takes a whole lot more time when you don't have resources and you don't have a car, and, you know, it takes more time to just live. You know, and if you're, you know, living in an apartment and you got to go to the laundromat, you don't have the washing machine in your house. So life itself is just more costly in terms of time. But then if you have a culture that values busyness, they don't see that as a problem, and it is a problem. And that's where busyness affects lower wage workers, is because they really need that. If they need their bread. They're getting really crummy bread. They need to work on getting them better bread, but they really don't have roses either, and they deserve and need roses just like everybody else.
Right. Wow. Good stuff, Bridget. This has been great. Very, very personal, which is great. You're very open and authentic. So I really appreciate it. I love the Christmas card story, Christmas letter. It's pretty amazing. Because you're right. When you read these things, it's like it is exhausting. Like, you sure did a lot of stuff. And you're happy. Anyway, although I have to applaud the fact that anyone will sit down and do a Christmas card letter. It does take time to do that. But again, I wanted to applaud you and thank you and remind people of the book, Overwhelmed, How to Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. And please follow Bridget on Twitter, at Bridget Schulte. Is it Schulte or Schulte?
Well, yeah, it's sort of the Americanized way of saying an old German name, but yeah, Bridget Schulte.
Okay, Bridget Schulte, right. And again, thank you so much for being with us. Also wanted to let everybody know about next month. It's Sue Rasmussen. She's the author of My Desk is Driving Me Crazy and Overwhelmed, Do Less and Accomplish More. And that's on Tuesday, September 26th at 3 p.m. Pacific. As you can tell, our theme this year is overwhelm, stress. We've done this now for our 14th year, and we try to have a new theme every year. We're thinking about next year doing scaling as a theme. If anybody has an idea around some themes, we're open to that. We want to hear from you, so please email me with that. So again, everyone, thanks so much for being with us. We know you're busy, so this is great that you can be with us live. If you have certainly a time to forward this to your friends and colleagues so they can listen in, I think that they would really appreciate that. Thanks again, Bridget. I really appreciate you being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great talking to you.
Okay, take care. Bye, everybody.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, bye.
Bye.